You're listening to Spellbound. Welcome to episode 31 of Spellbound. I'm Julian Smith. Spellbound is now a CastBox original. You can still listen to it anywhere else you typically listen to podcasts, but check out CastBox today and see what's making it the fastest growing and highest rated podcast app for both iOS and Android. I'm here today with Allison Van Enenam and Andrew Rader.
Hey, right. Back.
Andrew Rader's back. Thank you for being here, Allison.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me on.
We're excited to talk to you. You've got some interesting stuff to share today about the environment and the way people eat, the way people live, and how our choices are affecting the world we live in that we all have to share. You are a cooperative extension specialist in the Department of Animal Science at UC Davis, where you also run the Animal Genomics and Biotechnology Lab. And you've served on an advisory committee for the USDA and received the Borlaug Cast Communication Award in 2014. It's great to have you here.
Yeah, I guess I'm an agricultural scientist, so that's kind of the field that I work in. And agriculture touches on a lot of different topics because everybody eats. And so a lot of different opinions out there, and try to stick by what the data says to make informed decisions around how we should proceed with agricultural production systems.
We're interested to talk to you about this because, you know, agriculture is a recurring theme on this podcast, and, you know, we talk about it a lot, and I think you're the first actual agricultural scientist we've had on. But the one thing I'm most interested to talk to you about is your experience being a cow pimp.
I don't know that pimp is quite the right word, but yeah, that's pretty much what my job is.
Artificial cow insemination. This is fascinating. I didn't know this happened. I want to hear all about this.
Yeah. Well, and I think the understanding of animal breeding and how sophisticated it really is something that most people aren't aware of. And I sometimes joke that, you know, my job is a little bit like Tinder. So I'm setting up the very best males with the very best females based not on how they look, but on how I expect their offspring to perform. So it's kind of hard-headed dating in terms of I'm only interested in what genetics you can give to the offspring. I'm not that interested in what you look like. And so we use very sophisticated approaches and math and algorithms to really make the best selection decisions in both plants and animals, although it's more fun with animals. And we have made amazing genetic improvements as a result of that. And that's important, not only just for the interest of animal breeding, but in terms of the environmental impact that has on reducing the resources required to produce our food.
So you're reproducing cows that people are eating, or is this like, does it become leather, or what happens to the cows you're inseminating?
Well, all of the above, right?
Okay.
So cows don't just produce food, right? And of course, there's dairy cows that produce milk, and then there's beef cows that are raised primarily for beef.
So you're dealing with all of it.
Right. My focus tends to be beef, but I also dibble a little bit in dairy just because there's some interesting gene editing work that we're doing in dairy. And that happens to be a group of cattle that grow horns. And so we've been working in collaboration with Recombinetics to develop some gene editing approaches to basically tweak the gene that grows horns so that those animals are genetically no longer growing horns and therefore don't have to have their horns removed to protect other animals and human handlers from horns. So I do a bit of research in both, but I want to put something in perspective for you guys. So if you look at the dairy industry in the United States today, there's about 9 million dairy cows in the US. And if you look back in the 1950s, there was about 26 million. So the numbers have dropped dramatically from 26 million down to 9 million as a result, basically, of the genetic selection to improve the production per animal. And so if you look at that overall, there's about 1.6 times more milk today than there was when there was 26 million cows. And that effectively has a really big impact on the environmental footprint of a glass of milk relative to what it was in the 1950s. And a lot of that is due to improved genetics. And a lot of that was enabled by the use of artificial insemination and these sophisticated breeding algorithms that kind of mate the best male with the best female based on science and data and trying to improve the efficiency of the offspring of that mating.
I'm assuming, Allison, that you get a decent amount of people thinking that what you do is controversial. Am I safe in assuming that?
Oh, you mean working on biotechnology and animal agriculture? Well,
you just don't have a typical stance on this. Like some people are typically either, you know, they're saying don't eat meat ever, don't buy any animal products, you know, and then you've got people on the other side just saying like, oh, I never eat plants at all, and all my car seats are leather, and you're kind of somewhere in the middle, and I don't really fully understand your perspective yet, but I want to understand that. I think that's going to be the interesting part about letting you speak to us is just kind of defining your perspective on this, because this is a really hot button issue, and the data that you provide and the arguments that you make are just not traditional.
Yeah, well, I don't, if you get to know me, I do not like dichotomous framings of anything because I think everything has pros and cons and trade-offs. And I get very frustrated when you have a black and white framing around agriculture of any nature. And so I think the two extremes you just suggested, you know, that never ever animals or only ever animals as part of your dietary choice just doesn't make sense. What I see often happening, particularly, you know, I live in Davis, so I'm kind of surrounded by some, you know, liberal-minded philosophies, is that the stated impact of our dietary choices and particularly animal products on our environmental footprint tends to get blown way out of proportion relative to the other aspects of our life. And I guess I will cite just a recent paper that came out in the Proceedings of the National Academy, where a couple of scientists took the thought experiment to its logical conclusion and said, okay, let's remove all animal agriculture from the US agricultural production system. What would be the impact of doing that? And if you ask just the normal audience, you know, what that impact would be, it might be, you know, some people will say, oh, I don't know, it would reduce our greenhouse gas emissions by 50% or something like that. And in fact, if you look at the data, agriculture as a whole is only about 9% of US greenhouse gas emissions. And of that, animal ag is somewhere down in the 3% range.
So this is 9% of like the global emissions and environmental impact from emissions.
Just the U.S., but including transportation, heating, industry, things like that, right?
So these are U.S. numbers. And I think that's a really important proviso, because depending where you're discussing, removing animal ag or eating animal ag products has really different implications. And so many people tend to focus on their situation where they have calorie sufficiency and nutrient sufficiency and have choices available as to how they are going to do their diet. And that, I would argue, is what we have in the US. That's certainly not the case elsewhere. And so I think if we want to have a discussion around this, we need to be really clear about, well, where are we discussing this? And in this particular situation, I'm giving the data for the United States. So I'm happy to discuss global issues, but this is what this data shows. And basically, what this report showed that if you did remove all of the animal ag from the US agricultural production system, the reduction in greenhouse gases was somewhere around about, I think, 2.5% of our global emissions. And so that's where, and that's not nothing.
It's not that much.
Well, I'm not belittling that. It's not nothing, but much bigger impacts can be had by modifying, for example, plane travel. You know, I think switching from an omnivore diet to a vegan diet has about half the annual impact that a flight to Europe and back has, one flight. People tend to focus a lot on the dietary choices where, you know, you move from, I don't know, eating meat to a plant-based diet or whatever thing, without really looking at the things that are really impactful in terms of our personal footprint in terms of greenhouse gases, because a lot of the things that make big impacts are less palatable, quite honestly. Transportation is a really big impact. Energy is a really big impact. So things you can do to reduce that have really big impacts. Getting rid of your car has a really big impact, but that's probably not a reasonable thing to ask of people. And so I think that just keeping the dietary choices in perspective is important. And then there's a more nuanced discussion about, well, what is the roles that animal play in our environment and working landscapes? And what, for example, would happen if you remove all animals from our rangelands, for example? And we test that a lot in California, because we often have places that are bought by conservancy groups that then remove all grazing ruminants And then basically those places have uncontrolled forage that ends up with wildfires. And so, you know, there's more to ruminants than just meat eating. They also have a role in environmental services as well that I think has to be part of this discussion.
So you're not saying that going vegan or vegetarian isn't helpful. You're just saying it's not going to make, if your concern is environmental impact, you're not going to make nearly as big of an impact by going vegan as you are by like reducing your plane flights or driving your car less or something like that.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's what the data shows. There's an interesting paper that came out that showed what really makes a big impact to your dietary choices is, in the US situation, consuming less of whatever it is you're currently eating. And that's probably good for your health as well. And that's true, certainly, for people who are overweight, but that's not true for someone that's underweight, right? And so it depends a little bit on what your current diet is and what your sufficiency is as to what makes a sensible dietary choice. But yes, in answer to your question, I think that the impact is going to be no more than the 3.8% that is responsible for animal ag, and you're going to have to replace that protein with protein from somewhere else. And so overall, the reduction is something like 2.4%. And so just keeping that number in perspective and you know, I kind of agree with grandma, everything in moderation. Try not to drive so much, try not to fly so much, try not to turn on air conditioning so low. I mean, just these common sense things are really as important as the dietary discussion.
So I shouldn't have my thermostat set at 55 right now?
Well, if that's what you've got it set at, then shame on you.
Allison, the study you're talking about also said that there would be an increase in food availability, I guess it is, or food production. I mean, I guess number of people that could be fed by 23% or something like that. Is that misinterpretation or is that not? And the other thing is you lose efficiency. This is related to you lose efficiency at every trophic level. Every time you feed an animal food, you have a net energy loss. And then you feed, you know, from the herbivore to the predator and stuff like that. And you lose energy there too. So where is the difference coming from? Is it coming from like the fact that this unused land that couldn't be used for agriculture that's being used for meat production?
Right. So as you correctly mentioned, there's feed that goes to animals that land could then be used to grow food for humans. Right. And that's kind of the argument you'll often hear as to why this is going to have a big impact on our environmental footprint, because you lose, you know, often particularly ruminants get held up because they're inefficient at producing a pound of gain from a pound of feed. But I, in their defense, and I do work with cows, so I, you know, I do realize I have a bias there because I think they're pretty amazing because they're the only ones that have the four compartment stomach, you know, the ruminants, well, them and sheep and goats, so it's not just them, that can take inedible cellulose and create energy. And the way they do that is through the microbes in their rumen, in their big four compartment stomach. And those guys, the little bugs in there, are the ones that produce the methane. And so there's a trade-off there. So it enables you to utilize land that has no other human food purpose, because a lot of cattle, in fact, the majority, are grazing on rangelands that are rain-fed, that have no other human food purpose because they're too hilly for crops and they have no water source. And they're taking that land and taking inedible forage, i.e., you know, grass, and consuming it and turning it into, or upscaling it, if you will, into human edible protein. And the way they do that is from the energy produced by the methanogens. And then the methanogens, of course, release the methane. So if you get rid of that ecosystem service, that land doesn't otherwise produce any food. It basically is just no longer a part of the food supply. And that's where most of the ruminants live, is in these inhospitable areas where the land has no other human purpose for food. So yes, they are inefficient, but they're also taking otherwise non-edible feed for humans. And when you look at the other types of animals that are more efficient, so the single-stomached animals like us, so pigs and chickens and fish, they are typically eating food that equally could be human edible. And so they actually compete fairly directly for human food. And in fact, globally, the livestock of the world, only about 14% of the food that they eat is directly competing with humans. So 86% is otherwise inedible land, so forage, or byproducts. Like, for example, the almond industry in California, we have, and if you drive down the valley anytime soon, like the almonds are just taking off like weeds. But really important byproduct from them is their almond hulls. Well, what happens to the almond hulls? Do they all go to a landfill? No, they get eaten by ruminants, i.e. our dairy cattle. And so they're recycling food waste. And
they
there's
eat the
a
shells?
Lot of that. Yeah, the almond hulls. It's a really good source of protein.
Wow.
And they do a lot of, so that if you go and drive to a dairy farm in California, you'll see cotton seeds that are coming from cotton milling. So they eat the seeds. They will often eat bakery waste. And I've been on a farm where they were feeding them the what do you call those colorful Cheerios, the kind of snap, crackle, pop, I forget what they're called, but the really bright colored breakfast cereals. It was some sort of a reject lot. And that was getting fed to the dairy cows. And so they do a lot of digestion of otherwise inedible human foodstuffs. And there was actually a paper that came out of Wageningen in the Netherlands that says if you totally remove animals from production systems, your overall food production is actually going to go down as a result of the lack of the recycling of these otherwise human inedible byproducts that's done by ruminants. And so I think they have a role. I feel that when people just say, let's get rid of them all, it really doesn't appreciate that they have this particular niche and this particular pretty cool biological attribute of taking inedible food or feed and turning it into milk and beef. I was raised in Australia, and so I only ever knew that cows ate grass. and so, yeah, I mean, when I first saw the American system, I'm like, well, that's weird. But as you understand, well, why is it right? Why are cows raised the way they are in different environments? You know, why is Brazil like it is and Australia like it is? It's all got to do with the comparative advantages of that landscape and what makes sense from a farming perspective in those particular environments. And so it would make no sense whatsoever to basically, you know, try and do corn-raised beef in Australia because we don't have a corn belt. whereas it makes sense in America, because you've got that competitive advantage of a corn belt, and they basically get fed the last 60 days or so of their lives on corn to get them finished by 14 months. Whereas in Australia, if you're just eating grass, that's fairly low energy. It takes somewhere around about 3 years to get to market weight. And so there's very real environmental impacts associated with that. And not that, you know, one's perfect and one's horrible. They're just different. And so you're going to have less emissions associated with a pound of beef that's been finished at 14 months than you will with a pound of beef that's been around for 3 years, because by definition, you just need more energy to live 3 years. And so you get this thing called maintenance energy, where every day you need a certain number of calories just to live. And that's true if you're a human or an animal. And so the longer it takes to get animals to market weight, the more maintenance energy they require. And that basically increases the footprint of getting the product from those animals. And so a lot of animal breeding is trying to get animals to market, utilizing as few resources as possible. And that basically is, you know, a very important selection objective.
One of the arguments is that cows in their natural habitat, natural environment, when, you know, before we domesticated them, wouldn't have been eating corn and wouldn't have been eating Cheerios or whatever, Rice Krispies or whatever it was.
Tricks are for kids.
Exactly.
That's what it was.
So maybe it's
tricks are for cows.
And so I don't know, but people say, so this is bad for cows, it creates emissions, maybe it's bad for them, so we need to inject them full of antibiotics, especially with the high capacity that we have. So, you know, we get all these negative effects of antibiotic resistance growing from the agriculture industry. We get maybe more emissions from the cows who are eating this stuff that they're not naturally eating, stuff like that. Is there any truth to that?
So the first one was that you get more emissions from eating the corn. That's actually the exact opposite. So the methane is coming from breaking down roughage or cellulose. So the more dry matter there is in a diet, the more methane emissions you'll get per pound of feed consumed. So if you're feeding a very high energy diet with very little roughage, which is basically what they get in the last 60 days in the feedlot, there's very little methane emissions associated with that phase of a cow's life. It's basically when they're out on forage or otherwise inedible cellulose, to use my previous term, that's when the methane emissions are there. And that's the trade-off you get from having them consume otherwise inedible cellulose, right? And so that's coming from the methanogens when they're digesting cellulose. So in fact, if you're looking at the overall impact in terms of methane emissions, the more fiber or the more forage, more grass you have in your diet, that'll be proportional to emissions. So it sounds counterintuitive, but that's what the data show. That's actually, if you look at the life cycle of a cow, the least emissions are associated with those last 60 days in the feedlot. But they were using land that otherwise wouldn't be providing any human food for the rest of their life when they were grazing on rangelands, right? So there's that trade-off. The other thing you said is that injected full of antibiotics, was that the term you used?
Mm-hmm, yep.
And, that's just such a pejorative, like, really? Why? Why are they doing that? Why would they be injecting antibiotics? So I see cattle and I see what happens. So they will be treated with antibiotics if they get sick, and then they might be injected with an antibiotic if they have a particular illness. But I do the same with my kids. I don't necessarily inject them with antibiotics, but typically if they get sick, they might take some oral antibiotics, because that's what you do to be humane. And if you don't do that, what happens? You know, do you just let them die? Your kids or your cows? You know, I mean,
is it a result of living in high density, though? That's the question. So basically, if you have grazing animals, and I know you're definitely a proponent of new agricultural system of high density and stuff, like, as you're saying, it's more efficient, right? But is there a trade-off there that the more closely you pack the animals together, the more likely they are to transmit diseases to each other? So they actually need the antibiotics, where if they were low density out in fields somewhere, they wouldn't need it. Like maybe in Australia, they don't need the antibiotics as much because, as you say, they're not finished in high density.
Right. Yeah. I mean, so to some extent, there is when you bring animals together, it's a little bit like kindergarten. The first year when your kid goes to kindergarten, you're home almost every week because they've been exposed to new viruses and they get colds and then you get it and then everybody's miserable. That is actually the case. And so because if you're bringing in mixing animals together, you can introduce them to new viruses and bacteria. And that's one of the trade-offs associated with having animals in close confinement. The alternative to that would be a pastoral type system like in Australia. And so in that case, the trade-off there is it you don't finish them very efficiently. So they're out in the pasture for 3 years instead of being finished in 14 months. So, the illness trade-off versus the environmental trade-off. And I guess that with this whole sustainability question, it's what is it? What's your objective? Because the term sustainability is as squashy as beautiful. You know, what I think is beautiful and what you think is beautiful are probably entirely different things. And you can basically optimize the different metrics of sustainability, be it methane emissions or water use or different, you know, providing protein efficiently, doing it in a way that doesn't compete for human food. Depending which of those metrics you're trying to optimize, different production systems will appear to have better metrics than others. And I think that that's part of the nuanced conversation around why it's so difficult to have a dichotomous framing where all animals are bad or all animals are good or, you know, we should never do this or never do that. And it really annoys me with any agricultural production system where you have forbidden methods, because sometimes a certain method might make the most sense for a particular environment, and it doesn't make sense to have arbitrary exclusions of different things. And I see that with the never ever antibiotic programs that they have in the market now, and I go there and I see what happens to those animals, and they're legally meant to be treated if they're sick, and then they go into the conventional food supply system. And so you've got actual supply systems set up that rely on the fact that someone else's consumer is going to eat their rejects. And that just seems, I don't know, a little bit morally bankrupt to me. So we're going to treat sick animals because we know they have to be treated. But when they do that, they're no longer eligible for our superior consumers who, you know, are bragging about them eating their never ever products. But we do acknowledge we use it, and we're just going to dump it on, you know, those people that are eating conventional beef or milk. You know, it's like, really? That's appalling.
What about bovine growth hormone? That's something that we don't allow in Canada, for example, but I know that it's used widely in the United States. I don't know about Australia.
So it's a really interesting story. So bovine growth hormone, or recombinant bovine somatotropin is kind of the official name for it, is a protein-based growth hormone. So protein, not a steroid. So it's a protein-based growth hormone that was developed using genetic engineering, or quote-unquote GMOs. And it was introduced about 20 years ago into dairy production systems. And it's an injectable protein that you can give to dairy cows that increases their yield or milk production by somewhere around about 7%. And so it was kind of the first time that the anti-GMO industry kind of flexed its muscle. And there was an activist by the name of Jeremy Rifkin at the time, who started a whole bunch of campaigning saying that milk from cows that had been treated with RBST or growth hormone was going to give you cancer. And so, you know, of course, the FDA had done all their evaluations and everything, and there was no evidence to support that. But cancer is, and food, it's like, it's the ultimate, you know, fear tactic. And this information was spread. And so certain marketers said, aha, we've got an absence label claim here, that if we put an absence label of made from cows that weren't treated with RBST, we'll be able to charge more. And so that kind of took off, and it spread. And now I believe I'm correct in saying that it is no longer utilized in the United States by dairy producers, because basically every creamery ultimately had the absence label. So now nobody gets the quote-unquote market, short-term market benefit for that. But we've lost a 8% tool from use in animal agriculture based on no data. So fear-mongering drove a technology off the market that now has, if you want to think of it this way, we're now got 8% less efficient dairy production than we could have.
Which is bad for the environment, basically. So if you eat Ben and Jerry's no GMO, then it's bad for the environment.
So well, this RBST thing is actually bad for the environment. Like to get RBST free dairy is actually worse for the environment by 8%.
You have to have more cows to produce the same amount of milk.
That's exactly right. And I mean, if you want to see what actually has driven down cow numbers, it's genetic improvement, right? I mean, there used to be 26 million, now there's 9. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Thank you, geneticists and nutritionists. I'll give them a little bit of credit there, and vets for producing that more efficiently. But as soon as you say no RBST, then you need to own that increase in the environmental footprint of milk production. And when you say no GMOs and you put a little butterfly on your product, you need to own what that means in terms of how farmers then have to manage their crops, because the weeds didn't go away, the insects didn't go away,
right,
the diseases didn't go away.
There's no free lunch.
There isn't a free, and even worse, you know, I would argue if you look at the data as associated with GMO insect protected plants, it has dropped global insecticide use amazing levels. I think it's like 40% or something in China and India. And if anything, that's had a hugely positive beneficial effect on insects like butterflies. And so it's kind of ironic to me that the symbol of the non-GMO project is a butterfly when they're supporting not using a technology that has dramatically used insecticide use that kills a lot of butterflies.
That is fascinating.
It should be, it should be a dead butterfly should be their symbol, because, you know, there's no discussion of what is the trade-off of a non-GMO world.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly.
I personally have been trying to, for the last few years, eat primarily as much as possible organic and non-GMO and all that stuff. I mean, and now in recent years, I've kind of eased up a little bit, because my personal philosophy is that you can't really escape it. you can't really escape any of this stuff, especially if you're eating at restaurants a lot. And also, like Andrew was saying earlier, we've all been kind of eating GMOs. Like everything's kind of a GMO.
Corn is massively GMO. I mean, that's the whole basis of agriculture, is selective breeding, right?
GMO doesn't really mean anything. It gets used as a shorthand for genetically engineered. But if we're talking genetically engineered specifically, in other words, using recombinant DNA technology, there are no animals that are genetically engineered.
Right, there's two types. There's the selective breeding, but then there's active genetic modification.
Well, I would say active genetic engineering. I mean, you've been actively genetically modifying chihuahuas, right? But we just haven't been using genetic engineering.
Good.
So
good distinction.
I think, So, and I just, because that's often people's concern is the transfer of genes from one species to another. And that is different from conventional breeding, right? And so, you know, it may or may not be your concern or my concern, but that is some people's concern. And I think by muddying those two together, it's not helpful to the conversation.
Health-wise, from transferring genes from one animal to another, I don't think there's ever been shown to be any health impacts, but there have been sometimes unintended ecological consequences and things like that. But I mean, I'm actually generally in favor of it, but can you talk a little bit about your view on it?
If we're talking genetic engineering, it hasn't been used in animals because of the public outcry.
Oh, no, but in plants, we use it pretty substantially, yes or no? I thought that was true for corn and wheat, but maybe not.
So, there's 10 species, I think, that are genetically engineered, and it depends on what trait you're talking about. So, you know, the disease-resistant papaya in Hawaii, that's just a disease-resistant papaya to the ring spot virus. It's kind of the end of the story. So there's no unintended anything there other than you can now grow papayas. The other traits that have been introduced have been the insect-protected crops. And as I said, that's had a huge decrease in insecticide use globally. And then the one that most people focus on, kind of ignoring the disease-resistant crops and water drought-tolerant crops, is the herbicide tolerant crops. Interestingly, you know, there are herbicide tolerant crops that have been produced using conventional breeding methods, and they also are resistant to certain herbicides, and it's as if they don't exist because everybody focuses on the ones that are produced using genetic engineering, and exactly the same trade-offs are associated with the ones that are produced using conventional breeding, but somehow they never get discussed. And that's kind of, to me, the trigger being what technology was used to produce something rather than what it is you produced and what the impacts of that is really what's conflated this whole GMO discussion, because it's a technology that can be used for many different purposes. And depending on what purpose it's used for, it can have different pros and cons. And it's, you know, saying I'm opposed to GMOs is like saying I'm opposed to electricity.
Yeah.
You know,
right.
It's crazy.
Yeah. If I'm in an electric chair, I probably think electricity is pretty bad.
Right.
But I love sitting at my computer and having lights on. So, you know, it can be used for good or bad, if you will, or, you know, right and wrong. And I think that the products that have been brought to market to date, and it's only been plants because the fish is the only one that's ever tried to come to market that's an animal, and it's still not available in the United States. They have been associated generally with beneficial environmental impacts in terms of decreased use of insects and substitution to less harmful herbicides. And that's what the data says. So, you know, could tomorrow someone introduce a dangerous one? You could conceptually put, I don't know, a scorpion toxin gene in one or something. You know, you could, but would you?
That'd be fun.
And why would you? You know, and so I think that I find it very frustrating to just be arbitrarily opposed to a technology without considering the nuance of, well, what is it being used for?
Yeah.
And what are the trade-offs? So let's just say non-GMO. Okay, let's go back to using all those insecticides that we used 20 years ago. You know, how did that help? You know, the problem didn't go away. You're just using old technology to deal with it. And that's not necessarily better technology.
GMOs aren't that crazy when you think about agriculture in general, as opposed to just eating wildly occurring food. So it's not that big of a departure to think of GMOs in that respect. But the pesticides and stuff, there's got to be like some kind of adverse health effects to that, right?
Well, I think if you look historically, the pesticides that we use, there were some horrible ones. And as a result of regulation, many of them are no longer used. Mm-hmm. But if you actually look at the data, the toxicity of pesticides used in agriculture today is, you know, a tiny proportion of what it was back in the 1950s. And relative to the pesticides that occur naturally in your food, it's about 1%. Of the pesticides you eat is from exogenous pesticides. 99% wow. is naturally occurring pesticides, which equally can be associated with deleterious impacts if eaten in large quantities. But like, one of the most healthy things you can do is eat more fruits and vegetables because they have these compounds in them. And so there's, you know, Bruce Ames, who developed the carcinogenicity test, has a paper saying 99.9% of the pesticides we eat in our diet are naturally produced by the plants that don't want to get eaten. But in the levels and doses that we're eating them, they're not contributing to health damage. And in fact, as I said, that, you know, the worst thing you can do for your health is walk into a store and not buy fruits and vegetables because you're concerned about them having pesticides. Mm. Like, that's the exact opposite of what the literature says you should do. You should eat more fruits and vegetables for your health, not less. So I think what we see is that marketers will use the pesticide argument to scare you into buying their more expensive product that doesn't use the pesticides without acknowledging the fact that the levels of pesticides on our conventional fruits and vegetables are not at a dangerous level. And in fact, 99.9% of the pesticides you eat are part of the naturally occurring products that are in plants, because plants don't want to get eaten. And in fact, the worst thing you can do for your health is not eat fruits and vegetables. And there's this weird situation we have now where there's more expensive fruits and vegetables that are getting pushed by fearmongers. And people are saying, I can't afford organic, therefore I'm not going to eat fruits and vegetables. And I can't think of a worse decision for your health.
People are actually saying this?
Yeah. You will see people avoiding products because they're not organic and they can't afford the organic ones.
And so they're going to McDonald's or something.
Well, so they're not buying
any
beef.
What are you talking about?
Hey, no, are you suggesting this is all a conspiracy of big meat?
Yeah.
Well, some people think it is, I think.
Back to what Grandma said, everything in moderation, guys. You know, it's like, it's not that hard.
Yeah. Well, I believe that. I subscribe to that motto, too, because I think that the dichotomous perspective you're talking about that is so problematic in our culture and around the world, too, not just American culture, we've got to start seeing everything in terms of this law of conservation where everything has pros and cons and give and take. And I think that that's what's so interesting about all this information that you bring to the table. What do you think about grass-fed beef, wild-caught fish? You hear all these, you pay so much more for these things at the grocery store. Is this just more fear-mongering, or is this, are there actually benefits to eating this?
What about even a health benefit, like omega-6s? Is that any basis of that?
So maybe from a health perspective and an environmental perspective.
Again, it depends where you are and what's your objective. So if your objective is actually the health impacts of omega-3 versus omega-6 fatty acids in your meat, go buy some fish because the relative level difference in grass-fed beef versus corn-fed beef as compared to the omega-3 level of a pound of salmon is night and day. And yeah. So, you know, if you want omega-3s, go eat a food that has high levels of omega-3. Don't worry about the 0.02% difference. And wow. I think that often you'll see people really hype up the difference between grass-fed and conventional. What happens with cattle is they, because of the rumen, that damn rumen, all of those bugs desaturate fatty acids. And they don't care whether those fatty acids came in from corn or came in from grass. And as a result of that, basically desaturation in the rumen is it tends to be that bovine products have fairly high levels of saturated fatty acids, irrespective of what they eat. And so it's minuscule differences in the omega-3 levels. That's not true in chickens because they have the single stomach like we do. Mm. So if you feed them omega-3s in their diet, then their eggs will tend to have higher levels of omega-3 because they have single stomachs. And so I think that whole grass-fed thing. So if you're doing it for omega-3 health benefits, then go eat some salmon. If you're doing it for other reasons, because you think that grass-fed has a better environmental footprint, then look at the literature. Because I think that if you overall, that doesn't hold up in the system where you're finishing them at 14 months. But if you live in Australia, then probably that's a sensible thing to do because there is no logical corn belt to be used there to finish them in 14 months. And so there it probably makes sense. And you know, I'm a little bit conflicted because I'm Australian and I live in America and I see why each country does what it does, and it does what it does because of the competitive advantages it has from its environment. And that is how agriculture is done. There is no one good system or one bad system. So I think grass-fed makes sense in Australia. I think corn-fed makes sense in America. And it's just like that. And you know, the salmon discussion, the wild caught versus the farm-raised, what is it that you're trying to achieve? About half of our salmon is ocean-caught Pacific salmon, and about half of the salmon we eat is farm-raised imported Atlantic salmon. The former tends to be more expensive. The latter tends to be less expensive. They're ocean-raised. They're mostly reared in fisheries. But what is it that you're eating that fish for? Is it because you're after omega-3s? Well, both of them are good sources of omega-3s. Do you want to support the fishermen of Alaska? Well, then fine, buy the more expensive Pacific salmon. But understand that the Atlantic salmon is an efficient way to produce salmon for people that can't afford the more expensive ocean caught. And the environmental footprint, the energy required to go ocean fishing is dramatic. And so from an environmental perspective, there's a pretty good argument that could be made for land-based aquacultural systems that like what's being envisioned by Aqua Bounty, which of course is the GMO salmon that from an environmental perspective is a lot more efficient at getting to market because it grows more quickly. And so you might even make a sustainability argument that that's the most sustainable source of
You're
fish.
You're helping the environment, fighting fish, then, farm fish. Yeah.
People's heads would explode if you said that, right?
Right.
Yeah. And so, like, be careful where you make that argument because people are so fixed on their view of how agriculture is that if you dare to challenge them with some data, they will just, you know, go down your throat and say you must be, you know, a shill for big salmon or big beef or big GMOs or whatever it is you're saying. The instant response is going to be that someone's paying you to say that. And it's just, right. it's really lonely in agricultural science because, you know, we tend to work in a field where the people that are housed in university cities don't have a worldview that agrees with any of the data that we come up with on a day-to-day
right.
basis.
Well, you don't belong to a club, which is what's cool. I mean, you kind of piss everybody off, but you're also trying to unify everybody too. You know, I love when we have people on this show that come in and say what you're saying, which is that you have to be willing to learn something and use your head. And it's not about one simple blanket all-encompassing answer. It's like what you're saying. You got to think about what are you trying to accomplish in any given situation. Maybe eat a balance of, if you're going to eat meat, maybe eat a variety of different sources. If you're going to eat fish, maybe eat a variety of different sources. With any food is what I'm saying. With any food.
I think that's why everyone has an opinion about agricultural systems because everybody eats.
Mm-hmm.
And,
yeah,
and that's fine.
True.
Like, I find it really interesting, like, you know, one of you is a space rocket scientist, right? Like, I don't even pretend to know anything about rocket science, and I don't know anything about medicine, but I know a lot about agriculture. And yet I'll have people who will argue with me that don't have that lifelong career in agriculture with absolute certitude that they know exactly the right thing. And I don't find, I don't know, do people do that to rocket scientists?
Oh, yeah. Okay. Have you ever heard of flat Earth?
Okay. Was that you that made the joke that people all around the world yeah. belong to Flat Earth Society? Yeah.
Oh, my gosh.
That was a pretty funny joke.
Well, thanks so much, Allison. Do you have anything you want to plug before we go, a book or a project or anything you're working on?
I don't really have anything I want to plug, but I will say that I was involved in a movie called Food Evolution that's available on Hulu that talks around the debate around genetically engineered or GMOs, if you will. And it's actually narrated by Neil deGrasse Tyson, which some people will know is a quite well-known science communicator.
Of course.
It tries to address this kind of the dichotomous framing and what is the actual information around this technology and what are its potential uses? And I think does a good job of narrative storytelling in a scientific documentary, which is not something we normally do. So I would plug, if you haven't seen that, it's worth a watch. It was actually directed by Scott Hamilton Kennedy, who's an Oscar-nominated director, and it does a good job of telling science's story.
Awesome. Food Evolution. I'm definitely going to check that out. Thanks again for being here, Allison, and appreciate the time and you sharing your knowledge with us, and hope to have you on again sometime soon. Let's do it again soon.
Thanks, Allison.
Cheers.
If you, yes, you, I'm talking to you. You're in your car, you got your earbuds in. I don't know the situation, but I'm talking to your head now. If you're enjoying this podcast, consider subscribing on Apple Podcasts or CastBox, wherever you prefer to listen. That's fine with me. It doesn't make a difference. I don't discriminate. If you'd like to leave comments and engage with the other listeners, you could do that at the brand new YouTube channel we just launched, youtube.com/spellboundshow. That one is really starting from scratch because it's brand new. So if you like to leave comments, definitely go check that out. If you want to shoot me an email, you can do that. hello@spellboundshow.com. Although the best way to interact with me is to tweet or Facebook or Instagram me at Julian Was Here. Andrew Rader, the co-host for this episode, is at Mars Rader on Twitter. That's where he's most active. You can get him there. This podcast is the most rewarding, meaningful project I've ever worked on. I'm loving this so much. It means so much to me that this podcast is growing. The listener base is growing. It's just such an inspiration to see. Thank you for listening. Thank you for subscribing. Thank you for all your support. I'm Julian Smith. This has been Spellbound. See you guys next Monday.